Well, good morning. It's good to see you. Greetings to those joining us at Crossroads, Highland Park, Vernon Hills, the 01. Happy Father's Day, and especially to those fathers who are here in one of the campuses. Good on you. Mother's Day is like the third highest attended Sunday of the year. Because if you ask moms what they want to do on Mother's Day, often it's like, I want my children to go to church with me. Father's Day, sort of a low attendance Sunday. You ask dads what they want to do. Golf prominently figures in. Church, not so much. So anyway, glad that you're here. And we are, as has been mentioned, we are turning the corner. This is the last in this series called This Is My Story. And in this series, we have been looking at various people, biblical characters, and so we've sort of gone through a litany of folks, Paul and Joseph and Barnabas and Gideon and Mary and Esther and Ruth, and last week was Esther, the week before that was Cain, and today is Caleb. And we're focused on Caleb a little bit because Caleb's sort of a man's man, and that factors in a little bit as it relates to Father's Day. But this is more than just a Father's Day message. Now, I do want to acknowledge that at Christ Church, we spend a lot of time focusing on men. There's a lot of programs for men, and there's a lot of programs for women, and all campus women's programs are really thriving right now. But lots of churches have programs for women. We have a lot of programs for men, and we do that very intentionally because, first of all, we know we have to work harder to get men. And secondly, we think that one of the best ways to serve families, to reach families and to care for children and wives and moms is to engage men spiritually. And another reason that we focus on men is because men are struggling. And we had a program for 10 years. We did something called Men's Fraternity. We'd have 200-300 men out on Friday mornings at 6 o'clock in the morning. And people would ask me, they'd say, how do you get so many men out at 6 o'clock in the morning on Friday? Like, several hundred men coming, what are you doing? What are you saying? What are you offering, right? Well, so first of all, there is... many men are very aspirational. They want to be better men. They want to be, and when you say, we're going to talk about how to be a better husband, how to be a better dad, how to be a better friend, how to be a better son, how to be a better boss, how to be a better employee. Like, there's something that sort of stirs in the heart of men. It's like, yeah, I could raise my game. I need to learn about that. And I said, and some of it's sort of the venue, because it's sort of a mix between church and a sports bar, and we do some things that get people's attention. I said, but really, I think what's behind this, as I said, is that we approach this with the understanding that many men are struggling, and that many men have been hurt prominently by their dads. So many men are still trying to earn the love and affection of their dad, even if their dad has been dead for 30 or 40 years. And I said, so many dads push too hard. That's a classic dad mistake. I certainly have made it. Many men express love, especially to sons, by pushing too hard. Many moms make mistakes by not letting boys become men and sort of holding them back. And I said, so there's those two ways that men get hurt. Men also get hurt because they don't have good friends. It's not what gets rewarded and cultivated in this culture. And I said, and then there's just the whole challenge of trying to figure out what in the world does it mean to be a man today. Because if you talk about masculinity, you almost have this default response of saying, are we talking about toxic masculinity? Because masculinity is considered to be a bad thing. And I said, so we are sort of talking about all of that. And I would start every year men's fraternity, I'd say, look, guys, we're trying to figure some of this stuff out, but there's problems out there. I said, problems in this room. And then I had this litany of statistics. I'd say, 90% of all crimes are caused by men, and 91% of all violence is caused by men, and 94% of drunk drivers are men, and 95% of, you know, burglaries are men, and 100% of rapes are men, and which was not the only statistics. Men are far more likely to put themselves at risk to try and help somebody, even somebody they don't know. There's good statistics about men, but there's all these statistics about men that are struggling. And that was 10 years ago, and arguably the statistics now are far worse. And so you see that, you know, now it's just sort of a given that at age 4 or 5, girls are so much more school ready than our boys. And throughout school, girls outperform boys now. And in graduating classes, 2/3 of the students in the top 10% of the class are women. And then you go to college, and, you know, 10 years ago, it was a thing. I mean, it was a thing that there were now equal number of women as there were men in bachelor's programs. Now women absolutely dominate college's degrees. At bachelor's degrees, at master's degrees, at PhDs, in almost every discipline, there are more women than there are men. And you get to the workforce, and you see that men have been dropping out in significant numbers. 1/3 of men who don't go to college are out of the workforce right now. And they are struggling. And then I can sort of personalize this. Five of my fraternity brothers have died deaths of despair through drug or alcohol abuse or suicide. And there's just a lot of men, and it's not what we talk about in this culture in this moment, it's just a lot of men who are struggling. And so you've no doubt seen the books. I mean, they're coming out all over. Jordan Peterson, whatever you think of him, sort of made his mark by filling auditoriums full of young men and sort of calling them forward, saying you're getting pushed down for these reasons and calling them forward. And then you got on the right, this conservative senator from Missouri I saw came out with a book a couple weeks ago on men. On the left, Richard Reeves with the Brookings Institute, a liberal organization, came out with a book. He was told it was a career ender. You can't talk about men's struggles. You got to talk about, you know, the challenges against women. And he said, yeah, I get it. But look at these statistics of what's going on. So we're not going to fix that today. I'm not even going to pretend about that. But it's certainly there's an opportunity to look at a man, and he sort of falls in this man's man category for reasons that you'll see later on. I think there's something here for all of us, but we're thinking about and looking at the life of this guy named Caleb. So by way of context, Caleb is talked about prominently in the book of Joshua, which is the first book after the first five books, which are a thing. Moses wrote the first five books. So you get Genesis that kicks everything off, and then you got Exodus, which is, by the way, I mentioned this in my Friday newsletter, Exodus is trending right now. Everybody is talking about Exodus, including lots of sort of liberal public intellectuals are talking about Exodus. Exodus is a book about the foundation of society and freedom. And as we see challenges to society and confusion about freedom, you have all kinds of people coming out with books and lectures on Exodus. And not just pastors and not just rabbis, right? But sort of like in public settings, people are going back to Exodus. We're going to be in Exodus in the fall. I was there. I've been working on this for a year. I was there. They're following me. I'm always, but it looks like I'm just following the trend. I'm like, when I decided we were going to do Exodus, nobody was talking about it, although people have come out with books about it. So they obviously were thinking about it before I was. But we're going to be in Exodus and very excited about that. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. So Leviticus is the message to the Levites, the priests, about the sacrifice and all that. It's the book that stops people who decide they're going to read through the Bible to get to Leviticus and they can't make it through. Numbers tells what's happening in the 40 years between Moses getting the Jews to Mount Sinai and then Moses dying when they're back to the Jordan River. So Moses called, burning bush, all that stuff. The Jews are in captivity in Egypt. He, in the book of Exodus, they get out, right? And they go to Mount Sinai. They get the Ten Commandments and the law and all of that. And then they are to head immediately into the Promised Land. And they get as far as the Jordan River, which is the sort of the barrier. You got to cross the Jordan River to get into the Promised Land. not a very big river, but it's a river. It's a break in the geography. And they send in 12 spies, right? And this is where Caleb makes his first appearance. Caleb is the spy for the tribe of Judah. And for 40 days, these 12, so one from every tribe, because they're supposed to go scout out the land to figure out how they're going to take it, but also divide up the land into segments, because then they're going to draw lots and see which tribe gets which segment of land. So there's one from each tribe, and they are to go into the land. And when they come back, 10 of the spies say, we can't do it. Like, we can't take this land. So all 12 of the spies say, the land is great. There's all kinds of benefits to taking it, but it looks like it's going to be hard to take. But two of the spies, Joshua, right, who's going to take over for Moses, and it's the book of Joshua that we're going to look. Joshua's one of them, and Caleb is the other. And so this is in Numbers that I'm reading here. This is Caleb's response. So Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land. We can certainly do it. But the men who had gone with him said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it, and the people we saw there were of a great size. So the majority of people are going to listen to the 10, and so you've got the majority report that says we can't go into the land. The minority report, Joshua and Caleb, is not adhered to. And so this is a big, big bad moment for the Jews. They will decide they're not going to cross the Jordan, and they will spend the next 40 years wandering around in that part of Egypt. They're going to spend 40 years wandering around the desert, and everybody has to die except Joshua and Caleb before they can cross into the land. And you'll read about this. Psalm 95 has got, there's all kinds of references back to this bad decision that the people should have trusted God. He's already parted the Red Sea. He's already provided all this food for them. He's proving himself to be faithful, but the people don't believe him. And so you have the book of Numbers directing them into 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness. And then the last book in the Pentateuch is Deuteronomy. Deutero means second. It's the second recounting by Moses, the second giving of the law, the nomos. And so you've got all of the second giving of the law. Then you get to the book of Joshua. Moses dies. Joshua takes over. They're basically back at the Jordan River. So they're back where they decided not to cross the river and go forward. And now Moses is gone. Joshua is in control. And at this point, they cross the Jordan. So, by the way, the TV show Crossing Jordan, sort of a play on this. This is a bit, again, there's a team from Christ Church leaving later this week to go to Israel. One of the things we do, go to the Jordan River. You're baptized in the Jordan River where Jesus was baptized, where John the Baptist was baptizing people. But make a big deal out of the fact that here's the Jordan River. And it is a sort of a faith statement to cross it. The Jews, when they finally cross it under Joshua, you read about this in Joshua chapter 3. It's a big moment because this had been, right, this is where things had gone wrong, and now they got a cross, and they've sent spies ahead again, but now they're getting ready to cross into the land, and the priests will lead the way, and all the people are lined up to watch as the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant step into the Jordan River. Now, you have to understand the drama here because they can't swim, right? If you've spent 40 years wandering around in the desert, you missed the swim lessons you were supposed to get when you were 4 and 5 years old. And nobody knows how to swim. So the Jordan River is not that big. I mean, at flood stage, it's big, but at normal time of the year, it's not that impressive. You're like, this is it. Good grief. I mean, I can't jump over it, but this should not stop all these people. But it's very, of rivers, it has one of the biggest vertical drops of any river. And it's not clear, so you can't tell when you look at it, is this an inch deep or 6 feet deep, right? You just have to step into it. And so they're back at the Jordan, and they cross. And now we're going to hear from after they get across, they, you know, they're going to have some initial victories there. They're taking some land and taking some cities. And then we're going to hear now from Joshua. This is the second time. So he spoke in Numbers, in Numbers chapter 13, and it said we should take the land. They don't. 40 years wandering around in the wilderness. And now we pick up in Joshua chapter 14, verse 6. Now, the people of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kezite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me to Kadesh Barnea to explore the land." Okay, so he's talking about the spies. He was one of the spies. Joshua knows all this because Joshua was also one of the spies. And I brought back a report according to my convictions, but my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt in fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me, "The land on which you are, which your feet have walked, will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since that time." He said this to Moses while Israel was moving around in the wilderness. "So here I am today, 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out." And we'll just pause there and say, I doubt it. I met a woman, a friend of Sherry's. I'd not met this woman before. And what I had heard about her is that she did these Hawaiian Ironman competitions. And I said to her, "Oh, yes, you're the athlete." And she said, "No, I'm not an athlete." And I thought, oh, I've got the wrong person. So later on I said, I'm confused. I thought she was that person. She goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I asked her if she was an athlete," and she said, "No." She goes, "Yeah?" She goes, "You know, guys go out for high school football, don't even make the team, but 40 years later, having done nothing else, they still say they're an athlete." She goes, "Women don't identify as an athlete if they're not, you know, getting paid by Nike." She goes, "Yeah, so that's just the difference between men and women." So anyway, I suspect perhaps Caleb is not completely the same at 85 as he was at 40, but whatever. "I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day." So he's talking specifically about Hebron. And this is significant. It's a great place to have land. So understand, Joshua is, you know, forget the lottery system, right? I want this land. And he mentions Hebron, which is a nice place there, southern part of Israel. And it's where Moses, very historic, Moses had bought a cave there to bury Sarah after she'd passed away. So it's got significance to the Jewish people, and they want it for that reason. But it's also heavily fortified. It's in the hill country, and it's heavily fortified. So it's going to be hard to take. And he says as much. "You yourselves heard that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helped me, I will drive them out, just as he said." So realize what he's saying here. So 40, he goes, you know, 45 years ago, we saw them. This is what scared everybody. This was the most complicated, you know, conquest we were going to have. It's fortified villages, it's in the hills. All the advantages go to the people. That's what I want. So he's not just saying, "I'm still with you." He's saying, "Put me at the front of the line. give me the hardest assignment. Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kezite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. So, look, this series, we have been looking at, thinking about the decisions people make for right or wrong and how we could learn how to make better decisions in our own spiritual lives. Christianity is not about following the example of other people. It's not this I do. It's not trying to be better. It's not trying to learn all the tricks of the trade so that we somehow elevate our game. Christianity is this he did. We are celebrating Jesus, his death on the cross. However, we are expected, right, to raise our game. We are expected to discipline ourselves to godliness. We are expected to learn from other people. And so the Bible is a book that also, you know, shows us what unfolds over generations and calls us to follow good examples and to be alert to trouble that might not happen immediately, but is going to be trouble. And so in this series, we've been looking at all these different people. It's obvious why we might look at Caleb, right? I mean, there's so many things that Caleb does right. He obviously trusts God. We see that in the Numbers passage. We see that in the Joshua passage, right? I mean, he believes God. He's going to do the hard thing. It's also clear that he's an independent thinker. He's not swayed by the wrong thinking of the crowd. He is resilient after disappointment. He fails. I mean, at some level, he had to think, I failed. I was one of the spies. I had the opportunity. I did not persuade the people to make the right decision. And for 40 years, they're wandering around in the desert. And he's got to think, you know, maybe a different person might have been able to get this done. Like, might have been able to make a different argument, might have been able to persuade the people to trust God. But he's not, doesn't seem to be a cynical old man, right? He's coming there with hope and with energy. He takes risks, he looks past problems, right? There's lots of reasons that we could learn from Caleb. And for that matter, there's lots of things to learn from the book of Joshua. Many people don't like Joshua, because it's about the conquest. And so there's battles and there's blood. And people say, I don't like the book of Joshua. But that is a very myopic understanding of what's going on in Joshua. I mean, first of all, you're seeing in Joshua, you're seeing the promises that God has made earlier being fulfilled. These descendants of Abraham have now become a nation. And they're now not just a nation, but they're a nation that is in the land that God had given them. And we're seeing God's work at hand. The crossing of the Jordan River, again, is a big moment when the Jordan River parts, just like the Red Sea parts. You see God's power and his miraculous strength in the book of Joshua. You have the gospel on display in the book of Joshua, especially with the woman Rahab. So when the spies go in the second time, they find this woman Rahab, a prostitute, and they sort of cut a deal with her, and she is then going to help them so that they can have some early victories, and then she is saved. And you read on about Rahab, and you see she ends up in Hebrews chapter 11, which is the Hall of Fame of Faith chapter in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, She's not only saved, right, and not by works. She's a prostitute. She's not saved by her life. She's saved by her faith. That's what Hebrews says. She's not only saved. She's not only in the book of Hebrews, right? She is going to be mentioned more than Joshua in the New Testament. And she is going to be in the bloodline of Jesus. So you see what faith can bring in the book of Joshua. And I would also argue that Jesus is the new and better Joshua, and you see that just as Joshua is going to use violence to sort of take the land, the promised land, Jesus, the new and better Joshua, is going to bring violence upon himself to secure the promised land for us. There's a lot that's going on in the book of Joshua. So I think there are lots of reasons why we ought to pay attention to it. But there's two things I just want to highlight here about what we could learn from Joshua on the end of this series and on this Father's Day. So let me just highlight the most obvious thing. He's 85 years old, and he's still in the game, right? He's 85 years old, and he's not coasting. So I had to have a mea culpa about 6 months ago, and I wrote about this. I've said forever, the word retirement's not in the Bible. And then I was reading through Numbers, and I found the word retirement. I think that was not sure the translators didn't add that word in there. I haven't seen it before, but it says in the book of Numbers that the Levitical priests are to serve from 25 to 50 and then to retire. But for the record, two things to understand about that. One is the job, there was a lot of physicality with the job, and at some point you're like, okay, yeah, this isn't for you. You're a little bit, you've aged out of this kind of work. And secondly, they're not supposed to just do nothing, right? They are to be involved, continue to be involved, just not in that particular role. So, look, I want to acknowledge that that we say, you know, 70 is the new 50 and all this stuff, all these different things. And there's truth to that, right? I mean, we are in much better health much longer than in the past. So, yes. However, we have to serve in different ways, and there's much being advocated and calling people to find next steps throughout their lives so they're continuing to serve. And saying 70 is the new 50 is you know, yes, but no. You know, recognize 70 at some point is 70. I was, a couple months ago, I was on a snowy, Sherry and I have snowshoes, and so it's big snow, and I decided I'm going to go out on a long trek through the woods. Been reading about this forest bathing, right? You got to be out among the trees and you know, decompress and all that. So I go on this long trek, too long of a trek, as it turns out. And so now I'm exhausted and I'm trying to get back. And I try to take the shortcut, and I run up to a fence, a chain link fence, and I walk along the fence for a while, looking for a place to crawl under the fence. Can't find it. I realize it's going to add like a mile and a half to backtrack and to get out of this little cul-de-sac. And I go, okay, I'm climbing the fence. Like, I've done this 1,000 times. Not in the last 50 years, but I've done it 1,000 times. So it's about 10 feet, 8 feet tall, whatever. The first, it's a chain link fence. So the first thing, there's a bar that's halfway through. So I climb up a little bit, and I try to lift my foot up to the bar. And remarkably, it's falling about this far short to get my leg up to the bar. So I got to climb up higher so that I can actually step up to it. Then I swing over so that I'm on the top of the fence, except I'm like this. I'm going, oh, right, I've had a stroke. I've got bad balance, and I'm now 62. So I'm like, get off the top of the fence. Like, get off the top of the fence. So I swing my leg over, and here was the real surprise. So now I'm like this, and I go, okay, just going to slowly lower myself down. Except, and I've heard this now, these muscles here, like the muscles that provide resistance for that, yeah, those are among the first to go. So I start down and I make it in like, I don't know, 0.1 seconds. All of a sudden I'm at the bottom and I'm thinking, oh my, and then I'm just there, thankfully, in the snow. And I'm going, am I hurt? Am I broken? You know, And then I go, Woodruff, you idiot. How many days would they be looking for you before they found you here? Why did you think you could cross a fence, climb a fence? So 70, at least 62 is not 50, right? Or 40 or 15, which is probably the last time I climbed a chain link fence. So we got to be alert to this. There are phases, there are stages, but there is a stage of serving up through whenever, which is life-giving. And increasingly people are writing about this. Drucker said 25 years ago, he said, when people look back at this moment, he was talking about 25 years ago, when people look back at this moment, what they will marvel at is not the advancements of computers, not the advancement of biomedical stuff. What they will marvel at is that people were given a second adulthood and they wasted it. He's just talking about the fact that, you know, in your mid-40s, you have as many years left as a professional to contribute as you have already worked. But most people don't prepare for that second half of life, or the third, or the fourth quarter, or whatever it is. And now Arthur Brooks, the Harvard guy, has just come out with a new book called From Strength to Strength, talking about this. Bob Buford wrote about this with Halftime. There's lots of people. John Piper, and I put this in my notes. John Piper's got this famous illustration that he gives about two women in his church who were in their 80s working as medical missionaries, and they died on the field. And he said, you know, everybody was saying it's such a tragedy. And he says, no, here's a tragedy. He was talking about another person he just read an account that in their retirement, their big hobby was seashell collecting. And he says, no, the tragedy is not the two medical missionaries that died. The brakes went out and they were in a car accident. She goes, because that's not a tragedy. They've gone to be with Jesus. What's a tragedy is people with this much potential, and what they're doing is collecting seashells. That's the highlight of what's going on. Now, many of you are serving. Thank you. I went to three of the four work sites yesterday, so we had 200 volunteers serving in North Chicago yesterday. If that was one of you, thank you. And then the Holy Smokers and others were serving. And we have hundreds of people that serve every week, inside and outside the walls of the church. Yes, yes, yes. Here's the thing to know. Everyone wins when you serve, starting with you. Like, this is what brings value and purpose to life, finding other ways, other people to serve. Caleb doesn't phone it in. At 85, he's not only still in the game, he's saying, give me the hardest challenge you've got. So, from Caleb we can learn, right, that we can continue to serve. And then the last thing I'll mention here is that he provided cover for others. And this is not to be underestimated. So apparently there's a TV show or a Netflix show or a movie or something, I don't know. Sherry and I may be the only ones that haven't seen it. It's called Jury Duty. And it's about everybody's in on a joke or everybody's in on the thing except for one guy. And it goes for weeks or months, I don't know. But all these things happen, and he's the person that doesn't understand that this is a TV show, that he's part of a TV show. So this clearly goes back, when I heard about it, clearly goes back to these famous sociological studies being done in the, I don't know, 60s or 70s, the Ash experiment, where they had people in controlled settings. And I remember seeing these films in college, and it's comical because you got 10 people in the room, and they're supposed to say which line is longer, you're comparing lines. And the first couple times they do it, they're giving the right answer. And then they start giving the wrong answer. And the guy that doesn't know that everybody's in on this is here at the end. And everybody's giving the same wrong answer. And you see him look around like, I mean, this isn't a hard question, right? This is not, it's not 2 + 2 = 4, but it's sort of like that. And everybody's saying 5. And you see him, he's looking around, and everybody keeps giving the wrong answer. And so what does he do? He gives the wrong answer. Right? And they know that if just one person will give the right answer, even if 80% of the room gives the wrong answer, if one other person will give the right answer, then that person will give the right answer. And there's a sense in which in this broken, dysfunctional setting in which Moses and then Joshua are trying to provide leadership, Caleb is willing to be the person of faith, to be the person that says the difficult thing, to be the person that calls other people forward, right? He's willing to take that marker. And there's a clear opportunity and responsibility for people to do this. I want to say especially for dads on Father's Day. There's an opportunity and a need for people to do the right thing and to take the heat on themselves, to provide cover for other people so other people will also do the right thing. So there are many people that we can learn from. We come to Caleb and we learn that we can keep learning and keep serving throughout our life. I pray we will do just that. Let me pray for us. Heavenly Father, we thank you for a chance to call you Father. We, as fathers, confess. We, as earthly fathers, we fall far short of your fatherly wisdom and love. But I want to pray for men who want to be better and do better, and I want to pray for everyone as we think about serving on going forward and finding those places to love and care for others and providing examples that provide cover for others to do the right thing. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the example of Caleb. Guide and bless us all, especially fathers today. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.